Bonjour et bienvenue à un autre épisode de Le Arbillon Rare, ici sur Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, en ligne sur RadioReverb.com, sur DAB, et bien sur notre podcast. I'm Eddie Packham, and nous partons à tournée européenne on association of oldfootballshirts.com. Well, I don't know if you understood all of that, but just in case you hadn't heard, we qualified for Europe. I mean, for the first time in our 122-year history, the Albion are packing their passports. We joked about this, of course, in the past, but we've only gone and done it. But in truth, in fact, we've seen better performances than our 3-1 win over relegated Southampton this season. But the outpouring of emotion and joy at the end of the game was reminiscent of the win over Wigan that saw us attain our Premier League status. And our record-breaking season isn't open yet. First, we welcome champions Man City to the Amex on Wednesday. And then we travel to Aston Villa in our final game on Sunday. It would take a 16-goal swing to knock us off six, but we're Brighton, so we're keeping our fingers crossed just in case. Joining me today is, of course, Alan Wares, and we are delighted to welcome back the Argus's multilingual chief sports writer, Brian Owen. Welcome back to the show, Brian. Lovely to see you as ever. It's been, a historic week.
It has, yeah. Sorry I haven't been, mate. I had to turn this down a couple of times, but nice to be back, and yeah, so it might not get a French team. You never know. But,
I had written it in Spanish as well, but bearing in mind you were coming in and I wasn't going to risk it. So, I can send it over to you to read if you want. But
AD, are you telling me that mock intro was French?
Thank you to Google Translate. Yes, it was. Yes.
And you don't know what 97.2 is?
Not off the top of my head.
97.2.
Well, there you go. Thank you.
I think it would be comma two. I don't think they do decimal points. I think they do commas.
Yeah. Oh, yes, they do, actually. Yeah, so that'd be virgule.
Virgule. Yeah. Anyway, carry on.
I left school in 1989 now. I can't remember that far back, so come on.
It's like leaving yesterday, isn't it? 1989, that's when Palace got to third. So, you know, and we're never going to see them in Milan.
No, and there are many, many others. So, Brian, I mean, like I said earlier, it's been a historic week. It started on the weekend. We saw you at the Amex for the 40th anniversary dinner of the FA Cup final team, who very nearly got into Europe, had Smith scored, for which he apologised again. But of course, he did score in that game, as many people keep forgetting. But that would have got us into Europe 40 years later. To the day, we did it.
That's one aspect of that final that's forgotten, I suppose, as well, isn't it? It would have won the FA Cup, but it would have also gotten to Europe. I thought it just all fitted together so well. As we were saying just before we came on here, my own day started like the cup run away at Newcastle and finished watching those pictures from Wembley. And then we had that, and Gordon Smith actually said, didn't he, I really hope you get into Europe, and all the club. I think he said, get to Europe. And then there was the Saturday with the results, how they panned out with, particularly Brentford winning at Tottenham, having seemed like they would do nothing in the first half. And that all happened while Roberto De Zerbi was talking to us, actually, in a press conference. And then on to the Sunday, and was it going to be a repeat of Wigan, like you say, or a repeat of Bristol City? And it was when Evan Ferguson whacked the ball under the keeper a la Solly March in front of the South Stand, it was on course to be okay.
Yeah, I did have those fears, Al, going into the game, actually. But I mean, the other thing, obviously, we have qualified for Europe, and I do need to point this out, the fact that we are going to be playing a lot more games on Sundays next year because of it.
Yeah, Sunday, Thursday, Sunday.
But the transport situation was just, it was just ridiculous. I mean, we went to get a train from Brighton Station just before 1 o'clock, an hour before kickoff, and the queue was going down Queen's Road, past Jury's, almost down to North Road, and it was just ridiculous.
Don't forget, with the nature of forward planning that you like to think the club is doing, they will at least be having conversations with Southern Rail and with Network Rail and whoever it may be.
Yeah.
Actually say, look, we're probably going to be playing a lot more games on Sunday. I mean, it does mean, you know, I'm not trying to get political here, but there are obviously issues with the nature of overtime bans and what they used to call working to rule, and Yeah, there could be any number of issues sort of coming up with that. But if, you know, the at least we know that this is probably going to happen. I'm going to say probably because, like you say, can I mean, you know, Sod's Law says Aston Villa will turn around and stuff us 9-0. So, yeah, they're
going to be.
Go on.
It's still going to be Thursday night football, though, whichever. Thursday,
yeah, I guess
Sunday.
So, but not the Conference League, please. I mean, that, you know, there's a kind of a different kind of Norwegian club we get to play then, isn't there? So
I'm not being sniffy over which particular competition. It's just the fact that we're in it, and it's just an absolute delight.
Oh,
you know, I mean, we dream of these things. I mean, the likelihood is it is going to be the Europa, and that is, you know, we'll look at some of the teams we might be facing in that a little bit later on, but. It's we know, we already know that it's going to be Milan. I mean, the one place I've already actually been to, of course we're going to get that.
Oh, have you been to Milan recently, AD?
Yes,
I really wish you'd told me.
Well, I did, but you didn't listen now, but that's not unusual, is it?
Let's
just move on. Let's have a look at the game itself against Southampton then. And, there was a return for Joel Veltman to the team, which was, a delight. I thought we might have seen the end of him this season, Brian.
Yeah, I thought so when he went off looking heartbroken, didn't he? It was the Wolves game, actually, wasn't it? The 6-0. So we're not talking about Newcastle then. All these notes I've got night on the North.
Would you like to give us a recap on your evening in Newcastle, Brian?
No, it's all right. Let's talk about the weekend. I wouldn't mind a Champions League night, actually, going to St James's Park. It was a fantastic atmosphere and a brilliant feel in the city before and after. So I'll just say that about it. They've got to the Champions League, and amongst all the other things to do in Newcastle, one thing that will be a good night up there if you get to go to one of those games. As for the weekend, Joel Veltman back. It feels a bit ominous when people are pleased with the lineup, because so often, and this goes back to previous managers, you see complaints and grumbles on Twitter and what have you about the lineup, and it always works. And it's when people are really happy with the lineup that things don't go so well. But it did look like a familiar lineup, didn't it? A better shape, and Caicedo in his right position, and all seemed good. I don't know, almost too good, but all seemed set fair, didn't it, for the afternoon we wanted.
Yeah, Brian, I mean, it was very interesting, actually. I mean, just fast-forwarding to the end of the game, actually, it was very interesting what Jason Steele was saying after the game about the fact that, you know, that there's only 15 fit players at the moment, and there's players going out there, like, stuck together with paper and string and bits of plasticine hanging off them to just get them out there. It's very much a case of just trying to get ourselves to the end of the season now.
Yeah, and there are one or two probably that we don't hear about who may be not so fit. Even Lewis Dunk has been carrying a couple of minor issues. We were told in the press conference, well, today, that it'll be sort of yesterday for this. So there are, it has been. And also you've had these players, haven't you? Played, like Caicedo just keeps going and going. He's been to the World Cup and all that entails. So, It's been a unique season, it almost seemed that was the one thing at Newcastle, to go back to that De Zerbi said, the one bit of good news, he hadn't lost a player in that game, because it seems like for a while every game was one more player had gone down we weren't expecting.
Yeah, I mean, looking at that, the team that started that Newcastle game, Brian, I mean, obviously there was a lot of big hitters that actually started the game on the bench. Do you look at that? And the way they were performing, and I think that there's a slight worry about next season with the players that we might possibly lose.
Well, I'm not sure who's going to go and who's going to come in, but it does feel like De Zerbi could almost use this not to his advantage, if that's not too strong a word, that he does need more players. They do need more depth for what's going to be. And he even said it in the changing room, didn't he? In those clips, we're going to be fighting for all four competitions. So some of the players, he's got younger players involved, I suppose, who he's been keen to get them involved when he can, so that they're ready for this sort of time, this sort of circumstances. Various players out on loan. But the squad will have to be bigger, stronger, you would have thought. And there was a time when we thought Adam Lallana would be back, and that hasn't happened. It sounded like he would definitely be back before the end of the season, and that hasn't happened at all. Yeah, I imagine it's got to be stronger, isn't it, for what they're about to tackle, and it's almost been tested to the limit. But that might help in the longer term. Players have had opportunities, even sort of Della Fire. I keep going back to last Thursday, but he looked quite good at right back.
He looked brilliant. It was a right back playing right back, which is something that we actually need. And you know what? If he's good enough, then he deserves the opportunity.
But to be fair, Moises Caicedo is you know, he's certainly good enough to be a right back. It's just, you know, his talents are wasted if he's not in the centre of midfield, but he's certainly good enough to be. In fact, Pascal Gross is good enough to be a right back, and his talents are wasted there, you know. And there's probably one or two others. I mean, who else hasn't played there? Maybe Jason Steele should have a go at right back as well.
It is a rite of passage, isn't it? So
he is the new Glenn Hoddle. So, your point that you were saying about your players being knackered and the whole thing of the squad needing replenishing. I mean, look at what we've gone through this season. We did quite well in two of the cup, the two cup competitions. Plus, we had some players away. And like I say, it's been a very, very unusual season. We got to the quarterfinal of one, semi-final of the other, going out via the same route. And yet, you know, there we are at the end of the season, kind of just sort of stumbling over the line a little bit. It's amazing we've been able to pick up the results we have and still carry on scoring, still carry on conceding, but still carry on scoring. And so for the rest of us, it's a case of just be careful what you wish for. So if we are going to have an attack on four fronts next season, then, you know, the squad we have barely just got us through three. So, yes, it's got to be quite an upgrade. But by the same token, for all the stuff you hear, for all the rumour and counter-rumour, and for every time you look at Fabrizio's Twitter account, I'm still yet to be sold on the notion of either Caicedo or McAllister, for that matter, going. I mean, getting into Europa League really helps. I've yet to be sold on that story yet. I mean, especially as the pair of them have just signed, not that long ago, in terms of their contract length, you know, renewed their contracts. At the very least, it should honour them for another year, given the loyalty that the club has shown them.
Yeah, I that's something that I certainly want to believe, but I just don't. I mean, the fact that De Zerbi's actually pretty much come out and said it deadpan that, you know, that we're going to lose some of our best players, it is a worry, Brian.
But then he said, I didn't say that. No, but I think it is. I think they're bound to lose one or two. And I don't know how the economics of it all work out as well. If none of them left, what leeway that would allow for others to come in. I'm just looking at the lineup, though. If you sort of compare it to the start of next season to the start of this season, for example, Julio Enciso wasn't a first team player at the start of this season. Now he is. You see, the players even within the squad are going to be, some of them are going to be so much different at the start of the next season to this. Evan Ferguson wasn't a first team player. Now he's a sort of first choice centre forward. Karim Mitoma was an unused sub in the first match. So even if you start looking at the names from last summer and the names this summer, within a few of those names, there are a story to tell where it's not like the same player, so to speak. And there's probably one or two others if I scroll down a little bit more and thought about it a bit more.
Well, if you want to look at a marker, then I'd say look at the team that played against Forest Green Rovers, because let's face it, it was a League Cup game against the lower division side, where Graham Potter, as it was at the time, felt confident enough to put out obviously a lot of the kids, and when it comes to playing against a third or fourth division side in the League Cup, I mean, managers down the years have done that quite a lot. And you look at who played, you know, Enciso played, Ferguson played, even Poupillon played, Afaya played, you know, Sarmiento played, you know, and these are players who now have burst through. And yet when you were looking at them playing against Forest Green Rovers, you're thinking, oh, we're looking at the future of the Albion. You didn't realise how close into the future you were looking, though.
No, yeah. Go on, Brian.
Sorry, just talking to De Zerbi after the game against Southampton, he did mention we lost Trossard. So it's almost like he still thinks he's got to bring somebody in to replace Trossard, not another, you know, in terms of numbers. And he said there's already, obviously we know the names, but the, you know, stuff is already happening in terms of transfers. So as well, Pedro coming in, Sounds like obviously there's Milner and Mahmoud were the two who've been mentioned. So yeah, there will be players coming in, and I just don't, like I said, I don't know if they can, if it even works to keep everybody, just the economics of it all.
Well, one player that we might possibly be losing, or may never see play for Brighton again at the moment, is actually Robert Sanchez, which, again, a few weeks ago, that would have been unthinkable.
Yeah, I think it's up to him, basically. It sounds like he's... I haven't written too much about it. I've been slightly non-committal in that you don't know the whole story. Is just benefit of the doubt. Is there some reason why it's not just, I'm not in the team, so I'm going to... go off in a strop? Is there something more to it? Is there some good reason that we don't know? So just the benefit of the doubt. Because I remember one time he made himself unavailable for a Spain squad for some reason. But yeah, it could well be. And Zerbi said today that there's the door would still be open if he wanted. Will he stay? Yes, if he wants to, he can stay. But so it sounds like he's put the ball very much into Sanchez's court. But yeah, that could be... There's a lot of keepers coming through at Brighton, though, isn't there? We don't know how good they are, but you've got McGill, Rushworth, Beadle, I don't think, ready for the Premier League as yet, but he's obviously making a lot of progress. So, and they all play a certain way. So, you're right. He's one who could well go. Cole will as well, yeah. I guess.
I mean, Carl Rushworth is the one that I think the club's most excited about. I mean, he's been had two loans, been player of the season twice. We saw him play
season?
A few times for Worthing, and he just looked fabulous there. We, even that, I mean, obviously it's a much different level, but it's maybe they'll have a season in the Championship next year.
Where was he
Lincoln this season? He was their young player of the year. There's obviously Kel Sherpin, but the one big thing is how they play, not just the goalkeeping, isn't it? It's how they play with the ball at their feet, and I don't really know that much about these. Obviously, McGill, I suppose, is the man in possession, or he will be if Jason Steele gets a whack in the first half of the game or whatever. So he's very close. But I don't really know that much about how they play with the ball with their feet, apart from Beadle, I think, is pretty confident.
Sure.
So we'll see. Yeah, but that is a key thing as well.
Forgot about the big 6'8" Dutch fella. Still gets a return, hasn't he?
Yeah, but I don't think he's too good. I'm not sure he would have full confidence with that sort of the Jason Steele. Libero type role.
Yeah,
I'm still saying
he's
Glenn
certainly
Hoddle.
He's certainly taken on that role. Okay, well let's talk about the actual game itself, Southampton against Southampton. Then there was two brilliant chances for Karu Mitoma to open the scoring. I'm not. Sometimes I guess it's just not your day, Brian.
But I think finishing is his. A sort of Achilles heel. It's his weakness, relative weakness. He has had some really good chances to score. De Zerbi wanted 15 goals from him, and he's not going to get that, but he's had the chances to get that. And funnily enough, when people, because there's quite often a question, was one in this week's press conference from a Japanese reporter, and it'll just be a general, how is Mitoma doing? Because it's somebody who's only been to one press conference all season. And it'll be mentioned like his team play and sort of bringing others into play. But I'm thinking, why isn't he mentioned finishing? Because I think that is probably the weakness that I would, or weakness, the area to improve that I could see with Mitoma. And obviously the first one, it looked a really good chance. And the second one, it just came back off the post. But obviously Southampton probably had an even better chance.
They did.
I'd love to see the stats of how many chances that Mitoma set up for Ferguson. I mean, don't get me wrong, Ferguson has planted some of them away. But you have to say, and I know I'm talking about the second goal here, but the way he actually got past his man, irrespective of how much Southampton moaned about a non-foul, and it's a bloke who really doesn't want to use his left foot, because the cross comes in with the outside of his right foot. It was absolutely perfectly placed. And I mean, Ferguson barely had to check his stride for planting it into the far corner. Superbly done. It's interesting you're saying his finishing needs a bit of work. I'm actually still thinking that, irrespective of that pass he set up for the goal, I'm thinking sometimes his crossing needs a bit of work. I mean, as we discussed last week, AD, you know, he can get to the byline, beat his man, and he's yet to find someone, you know, waiting in the middle of the goal to knock it in, because I don't think that's actually... presented us with a goal yet. So Brian thinks it's the finishing. I think it's the final ball. So clearly, as much as he's exciting and wonderful to watch and one of the players of the season, you can still see there's plenty of room for improvement, which on a certain level is quite frightening, for especially for a lot of right backs.
Yeah, I mean, it's just excitement though, still though, isn't it? I mean, he's box office. He will get you off your feet, regardless of, you know, we saw exactly the same sort of thing with Kazengla Alawar at times, when, you know, he would excite you and then that failed to deliver the final ball. But, you know, like you said, it's a work in progress. He's still very young.
There is one aspect of his game I'd really like to see improve. Like to see him stay on his feet a bit more.
Well, we'll have
to... There's one or two times certainly the last half a dozen games, I'm thinking either you're knackered or you're not going to get past your man, or it's not going to happen, in which case, you know, recycle the ball. But he's going down a bit too easily for me. I know that sounds like a harsh criticism, but I don't think I'm the only one that sees that. That I don't think it's about a sort of not being strong enough on the ball. I think he's looking for it, and it's not something that sits comfortably with me.
Winger in going down easily, shocker. It's something that's been going on since the dawn of time.
He's not the last, absolutely.
No.
Also, do we take him? Have we got a bit accustomed to how good he is? And like you say, these are quite sort of harsh criticisms in a way, because we see how good he is. We see him going, I've always got used to it. And you hear people who don't watch him that often, or maybe like national media, national radio, TV, whatever, still raving about, love watching him. He goes past players so easily. And maybe we've just got too used to it, almost take it too much for granted. And, sensation to watch.
I am loath to criticise him. And it goes back to something that De Zerbi said earlier on in the season, that he daren't take him off. And he's pretty much played every minute of every game since he's come into the team. I mean, it was actually rare to see him actually be taken off on Sunday, actually. But, you know,
You were saying, Brian, earlier about Caicedo's the Duracell bunny. I mean, Matoma just keeps going and going, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. Yeah. And when you think he hasn't done it all season, when you think, like I say, he was unused sub at the start of the season, or he was coming on for 10 minutes, and the hordes of Japanese reporters who were there were trying to find, you know, things to talk to him about. But he's one of those indispensable players. And I don't want to sound like too critical, but it's almost like, how good could he be if he put away some of these chances, including in the FA Cup semi-final? And like you said, we've sort of got bogged down this a little bit, but too early on in the Southampton game.
I got one person who definitely can finish is Evan Ferguson, Brian.
Just whacked it, didn't he?
And, the ball stayed hit for his first ball. I mean, it was just out of nothing, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And did that catch the keeper out, taking it so early? I'm not sure. I think it caught everybody out, because it was one of those goals where quite often you've got the build-up and you can hear the crowd, the sort of the swell of the noise, and something's going to happen. And this just went from, like, silence to massive roar, because it was just literally whack. But he caught it cleanly, and I suppose I don't know if it's because it was really close to the keeper in an awkward spot, and the surprise element and the power, but emphatic is the word.
It looks like it's one that the keeper should have done a lot better with, but I think you're right. It's, you know, a keeper can do well if it's maybe sort of 2 yards from them, because then they can then get down and stretch. But when it's one that's about, you know, 18 inches from their feet, they've either got the choice of sticking their leg out and hoping it might hit that, or getting down in time. And of course, like I say, once that ball was hit, it stayed hit. And you'd have had to almost defy gravity, well, beat gravity in throwing yourself on the floor in order to get down quick enough. And clearly he wasn't. So, I mean, you can criticise a defender as well for not getting close enough, but you know, that's their problem. Let's put it this way: if it was the ball was on the other foot, we'd actually be saying, hey, why didn't you close them down, or why couldn't the keeper have done better? So, but like I say, I think it's probably something you can say with every single goal, given that every goal is theoretically avoidable. You can actually criticize anyone to the nth degree with their defending.
But what I try to do with these, especially with goalkeepers, is try and remember how you saw it the first time. Because also with referees, but now with VAR, obviously they get a second chance. But when you're trying to assess, did the referee make the right decision? But did the goalkeeper, should he have stopped that? Just try and think how you watched it when you didn't know what you were looking for. And I think there was a surprise element and a taking it quickly element on that goal. And in terms of not closing players down, maybe you should wait for the third goal.
Yeah. I mean, there was a surprise element and also the position of where he took it as well. Because, I mean, very rarely will you see a striker shoot from there.
Yeah,
but I mean,
yeah.
if it's my goalkeeper, I'm disappointed that I haven't saved that.
The only thing I might say in the keeper's favour also is it might have been partially unsighted.
Yeah.
I mean, so how excited should we be about Ferguson, Brian?
Really excited. Not quite as excited as they are in Ireland at the moment, but very excited. I mean, if you think we get carried away about Aaron Connolly a few years ago and now Evan Ferguson, have a look at some of the coverage that comes from Ireland. But he's come through the ranks and you see who the goal scorers were in the under-18s and the under-23s. And so you think of him as a goal scorer, but he's more than that. He does other things and he looks like an old-fashioned centre-forward, but he's not an old-fashioned centre-forward. He's a modern centre-forward. So I think there were bits in the Arsenal game where he was just holding players off and keeping the ball, even though it wasn't a headline-grabbing performance by him by any means. But I had sort of Albion staff sitting behind me there and they were sort of full of praise for him, how he was sort of coming deep and just making room for others. So I think, yeah, be very excited. What should I say? Reined in excitement, reasonable excitement, if you like, but also sort of appreciate, don't just judge him on goals.
Yeah, because I mean, didn't actually score that too many goals in the 23s, really. I mean, he was an all-round player for them, and it was, I mean, there was a lot of hope for him, and obviously he had the opportunity to choose like the likes of Liverpool when he signed for us, knowing that he was going to get the opportunity to come and actually probably get into the first team, and I'm surprised he managed to get in as early as he actually has, and I'm delighted, and he's become one of the first names on the team sheet now.
To be fair, though, that I mean, don't forget, it was needs must, it was necessity. You know, even I mean, most of the way through the season, we've been caught a little bit short in probably most areas, apart from maybe central midfield. And I think we've always managed to put out a reasonable centre half pairing, but you know, the striker thing or the person playing the furthest forward, let's put it that way, rather than a striker. Because the other thing I found interesting about specifically about that particular match against Southampton was that one tends to think that Welbeck and Ferguson are kind of like for like replacements, and they're clearly not. Because while Evans got a very much a wise head on younger shoulders, you can still see he's a work in progress. Whereas Welbeck, you know, he came on, did a slightly different job, slightly more withdrawn from where Ferguson was playing, and kind of bolstered the midfield a little bit. Whereas Ferguson, they just never gave the ball to him. Or the two times they gave the ball to him, he scored. Apart from that, he was virtually anonymous. Yeah, he might have got a man of the match performance, but I was just thinking, you know, the passing, the through balls through to Ferguson at times were abysmal. And when, like I say, when he did get it, then they were perfect. But Welbeck did a different role. So it's kind of, we're going to have a different thing again with Pedro next season, where I don't think necessarily we're going to have a like-for-like-for-like replacement. They're all going to do a different job.
Yeah, I agree. Now, obviously, Southampton did come back into this game, Brian. And are you concerned about just quite how porous we've become of late?
Yeah, there have been a few. I didn't really necessarily see it coming until that. Obviously, they got that one goal back from the set piece. It was for a few minutes, though, wasn't it? It wasn't really for that long. So
I think the until the second goal was given offside, well, it scared the bejesus out of them because, yeah, you know, they were making the same mistakes over and over again. I mean, the first goal was, I won't say it was coming, but you know, there'd been a couple of breakaways. They had been careless in attack,
and it was similar to the first goal we can see Newcastle. Was it the first one? Yeah, it was the first one.
The corner, the point is that near post. Yeah,
there are times when, and you can see it, that you know the ball comes to the edge of the area, and the crowd screams shoot, and this is what upset Graham Potter before us. What was it last season? is that there are times, not just that to see that there's a clear route to goal, which we in the stands can't necessarily see, but you've also got to consider if you do take a shot, where the ricochet, if it hits a defender, is going to go, because sometimes it can fall to someone on the edge of the area and then they're a for away. And I think that's certainly what happened with one of the goals. And I think that time we beat Bournemouth 5-0, we were attacking, and then they went up the other end and scored through a little bit of carelessness. So there's a time for discretion and a time for candor when it comes to attacking. And again, we always have to be careful what we wish for, because if someone does shoot and it falls to the wrong person, that's when we look porous. But thankfully, like I say, the second goal was chalked off, even though I at the time I genuinely didn't think it was going to be given offside. We got a lucky break, and you know, after that, I think we just tied it up again.
But Brian, I mean, when Tezerbe came in, he had a reputation as being a manager where you're more likely to win 5-4 than 1-0. But he came in, and basically the defense have been pretty much resolute and very rarely breached. But it's just been the last month or so of the season where we, you know, shipping those five goals against, which obviously a freak result against
Everton was 3-3, wasn't there?
And it's 3-3 Brentford. Yeah,
but there's been a lot of clean sheets as well. So I'm not quite sure what the reason is for. Obviously, Everton, they were sort of chasing the game from 30 seconds and were just caught very short of numbers at the back. And Everton probably played like they haven't played all season. On this occasion, I actually thought Theo Walcott was actually quite good. Remember, he is an ex sort of top Premier League player. He set that chance up for Alcaraz. He forced the corner for the goal that came from the corner, and he took that one very well. And I think that's also part of the Premier League, isn't it? Even the bad teams are quite good, and they have got good players. I mean, even when Wolves lost 6-0 at the Amex, they did look quite lively going forward at times.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I mean, thinking on the whole, there's been a lot of clean sheets Brighton have kept. And that was, I think they got in behind Estupiñán, didn't they, on this occasion? Mm. But it seemed to be a very mad 5 minutes. It seemed like a Southampton, the normal script when they come to the Amex.
Mm.
Well, this is the first time in the Premier League that the home side's won this fixture in Premier League terms.
It's kind of anomalous stat, but the other thing you have to consider is, I mean, it was a carbon copy of the goal for the first goal we conceded up at Newcastle.
Yeah,
and you think again, are we learning? You know,
the other thing there, Al, there is as well that with the way we conceded the corner, I was quite taken aback by it. I mean, I know it's quite common that a defender will just like clear the danger first and just put the ball out for a corner, like the way that Veltman did.
Yeah.
But I'm just so used to seeing our defender turn on the sixpence and set up another attack from that situation. I was like, oh, he's giving away the corner.
Passing the ball within 3 millimetres of the other player, and then, you know, and then scare the bejesus out of us and
score.
tell you one thing you don't need after you've watched the Albion is any centipods.
Okay. Well, I mean, it was a very nervy performance, generally speaking, from us. But there was the goal that pretty much settled all our nerves. And that is now from the record-equalling Pascal Grosal.
Yeah. Finally caught up with Neil Maupay and Glenn Murray. Although, you know me, I know, sort of top scorer in the Premier League doesn't count. It's top scorer in the top division. I mean, you know, we did have 4 years in the top division before this. And the record for me is still held by Michael Robinson. But
okay, so where is he on that list now?
Equal second with Glenn and with Neil. There's no one else in between them. So, and for someone who, you know, is Mr. Versatile, that's a pretty decent record. You know, for someone who plays central midfield, right back, the occasional wing back, depends on the manager. Attacking midfielder, defending midfielder.
Number 10.
I can see him in goal one day, you know, as well.
Oh, God, no.
But, Adrian, you're saying a nervy performance, but I thought the performance off the field was more nervy than the actual team. I don't know how. De Zerbi was fairly pleased with how Brighton handled that occasion, because it was a different type of occasion. It was like a season's work come in almost to fruition. He thought he was fairly pleased with how they handled it and how they played their style, their DNA, as he called it. I thought the crowd were more nervous than the team.
Do you know what, Brian? I think I agree with you there. I think the number of people that came into the game thinking, I recall being nervous. As whoever it was that said at the top of the show, was it going to be Bristol City or was it going to be, you know, Wigan? Both were on the menu, and I think that was the nervousness of it. And even at 2-0, you know, given the sort of like the mad season we've had, 3-0, you can start relaxing, but it gets to 2-1 and nearly 2-2. Yeah, I agree. I think it's more the crowd's nervous anticipation rather than, you know, I hope it was just one of those things that the crowd's nervous anticipation didn't get to the players. I don't know.
I think it was a mix of two things. I think there were some who were nervous and some who were pretty almost complacent, and neither of those things are conducive to making a lot of noise. You know, I was really surprised how quiet it was around the stadium for quite long periods, and the VAR I thought was a turning point in the game, but it was also a turning point in the atmosphere. And all of a sudden the place came alive, and what followed was the atmosphere that we'll all remember in 20, 30 years' time when we're talking about this. And it was a carnival afternoon at the Amex, and the crowd roared them in. And they didn't until that VAR, which I'd sort of understand. It's not being critical, because I'm the sort of person who sits and watches a match quietly. So, but it was quieter than I expected. And I think the VAR actually turned the football match, and it turned the atmosphere as well. And then what followed was what we were probably expecting to see and hear when we
I fully agree. I think what had happened was that the players actually then bucked their ideas up.
Yeah.
And after that, I don't recall Southampton really getting too much of a sniff. Certainly they didn't have any more breakaways that we needed to worry about. And yeah, we kind of sort of, you know, got the game, and you still worry about it. You think that, are they going to break away? Are we going to go on to 90 minutes with it at 3-2, and then Southampton bombard our penalty area for the next 8 minutes. I mean, that's the sort of like these things that worry. But as the time went on, you realise that their heads had dropped. They had run out of steam, and we just
and we closed
like
it out.
Sorry, and yeah,
and we closed
and
we it out. We
controlled it, and that's when the crescendo started.
Okay. Well, we'll talk about what happened next in a minute. But first, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. As ever, this show is brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com. And Phil has given us actually a rather lovely shirt this week, actually, I think. Brian, do you want to have a go at describing this one for me?
Yeah. So is it a white or slightly off, or is it a silvery shirt? I'm not quite sure. It's either white or sort of silvery. And across the middle, it's got a wavy stripe of four different colours, sort of grey, yellow, which is wider, then
it's black, yellow,
shade.
Red, black.
Is it? Oh, okay. I'm just looking at the colours. I don't know if this is
question. It's basically, this is a very shiny, silky,
right,
white
iris shirt. Yeah, and I don't know if this is a trick question, because emblazoned in, I was going to say triplicate, about five times actually, down the side, is the name of a South American football club. So on the one that you sent me. So I don't know if that was supposed to be obscured. Once Caldas. So, big clue there is, I think.
It's a pretty big clue, I would say, to who it is, and that's exactly who it is.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, and do you want to have a guess at what year this one is, Brian?
Oh, gosh. If it was in England, I'd say it was in the 80s, but let's say the 90s, mid-90s.
Okay, well, let's have a look and see what this one is. And this is what Phil has to say about this particular jersey. And this is your shirt of the week. And it is the 2001 home shirt of Colombian side Once Caldas, chosen because it was posted to our site this week. And I quite liked it. Once Caldas are nicknamed El Blanco or Los Albos after the colour of their home shirt. They play at the 28,678,000 capacity Estadio Palo Grande in the city of Manizales, which is in the central region of Colombia. They currently sit 17th in the Categoria Primera A League, which is the top flight of Colombian football. The original club was formed in 1947 as Deportivo Caldas, and in 1961 they merged with the local side Once Deportivo, as they had both gone bust, and they went on to form Once Caldas. They won the Copa Libertadores once in 2004, and they've won the Premier A four times and the Copa Colombia twice. The current squad features nobody you've ever heard of, apart from John Palfrey, who probably has a season ticket. Historically, Juan Carlos Genaro had the most appearances, with 605 games in goal between 1992 and 2016. And Argentine striker Sergio Galvan Rey heads the all-time top goal scorers for Los Albos with 185 goals between 1996 and 2003. Links to the UK are few and far between. Striker Oscar Estupiñán began his career with Once in 2015. He is currently at Hull City with 35 appearances last season, netting 13 times. John Villafara played 120 times for Once between 2002 and 2005. He made the move to the UK and played for both Portsmouth and Southampton in 2005, 2006 and 2006, 2008, respectively. But, of course, Phil has found a link to the Albion. The extremely popular Jose Izquierdo played 40 times for Once between 2013 and 2014 before his move to Club Bruges. He came to the Albion in 2017 and made 48 league appearances for the Albion, scoring some memorable goals along the way. Sadly, injury blighted his time with us. In 2021, he returned to Bruges, and in 2021, where he was registered as a player and was trying to recover from his injury. However, last summer, he is now a free agent. I love this squared, eh, Brian?
I spoke to him about Christmas time, and I've never followed it up, but he said he was probably going to have to retire. And I haven't seen that he's appeared anywhere. He was doing some cycling to keep fit. I collated some messages of best wishes ahead for Brighton ahead of the semi-final at Wembley, which you might have seen. And he was one of the players I asked, would he do it? And I didn't hear back from him. So, but I suspect his career is over. So, exciting talent he was. Just looking on Footmob, by the way, while you were doing that, their top scorer, Once Caldas, is 37 years old. So I don't know that he'll be one who the...
Are you suggesting that James Milner's going to be our top scorer next season?
I don't know, but I don't think they'll be looking at Deiro Moreno, even though he scored 9 goals in an average team. But Izquierdo, what another who gave us some great moments.
Another one of our South American contingent that we've been so good at finding.
Brian, could you confirm something for me? Is Once Spanish for 11?
Yeah.
Because have you noticed the other thing that I saw on that, if you go back to looking at the shirt, the way that the N within the Once is has been sort of designed, the two uprights that you have of the letter N are both of them, they are look like number ones, don't they?
Yeah. Oh, that's quite clever. Yeah,
that's a nice bit of design. That quite impressed with that.
It's the lottery in Spain as well, Once, but I don't know. It stands for something to do with the blind charity. But Once, yeah, that's quite clever. Anyway,
moving on.
Is this the bit of the podcast where you click that 30-second thing to advance?
So on to Europe we go, but the celebrations at the Amex, like I said at the top of the show, was very reminiscent of that against Wigan without the pitch invasion this time.
Therein lies the point, isn't it? I mean, we've been spending a lot of time. And this is something we had, especially when we finished ninth last year. Oh my God, 25 years ago we were doing this. We were at Hereford, you know. We were staring down the barrel of the shotgun that the farmer wanted to blow our nuts off with. and so on and so forth. But this is actually the difference between finishing ninth and finishing sixth in this division are, I think, an even bigger achievement than, say, the gap between, say, 15th and 9th, which we managed last year. The rise that we've had is way faster than I expected. I remember saying this time last year that the gap that we'd have to cross in order to get to somewhere like 6th is just going to be having to be so massive. Mm. And yet we then go and do it. And I was just listening to an interview with Jake Humphrey on the podcast that he does, High Performance. And he was talking to Paul Barber. And we've had Paul Barber on this show many times, and he's explaining this and he's doing that. And but then when you hear this particular one, you realize that he's saying it in such the descriptions he's giving are of a bloke so far high into the stratosphere of understanding the job that's required. Still making mistakes on the way, as everyone will, but bringing in De Zerbi, who himself, will acknowledge that he'll make mistakes, Paul Barber. And yet you don't hear of other football club, people saying, this is our job, this is what we're doing, this is our goal, this is our achievement, this is our aim. It's just a case of throwing money at things. And this is the kind of thing that you can achieve, sixth place. And I think other clubs will actually now take heed that you don't have to necessarily throw money at the issue. It'll help if you do, but you don't have to. And I think that actually that is probably one of the bigger parts of the achievement that is all the more impressive over and above some really nice football we've been playing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think one of the things that I've been struck by this season around the Premier League is the amount of clubs, and it's not just the Premier League, but the amount of clubs who've sacked managers not knowing what they're going to do next and who they're going to appoint. And they've sacked the manager, right, now what next? And you compare that to Brighton, who lost their manager unexpectedly and had the successor in place within a couple of weeks. And I think that is sort of slightly off topic, but that is an example probably of what Al's saying there, and that that contrast. And like you say, it's not how you things do cost money. It's not free to scout talent in South America, but it's how you employ that money, how you use it. But I think that was a really clear example, the amount of teams who sack managers and not known who they're going to get. And yet Brighton didn't expect to lose the manager, but still reacted.
I think can I just say that I think that at the time that we lost Potter, it did help. We did have one small bit of luck, in as much as during that September there were no games, so we could bring we didn't have to.
Well, there was meant to be games though. Well, it was,
yeah, well, there was meant to be. Absolutely. Well, I
a
think
train strike out... and the Queen dying kind of like helped.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you're going to put it that way, yes. I wasn't actually going to put it that way, but. No, the point is the club didn't have to scream. I mean, they would have been more than happy to have had Crofts and Lallana taking what would have been the Palace game. They'd have been more than happy to do that because at the very least, they'd have played exactly how they'd done the previous week, which was against Leicester, and taken them apart. So that the system was there. The fact that De Zerbi's coming and putting a new system is not the point. Those players would have known. It's not as though Crofts and Lallana would have actually then turned everything upside down. But no. Like you say, it's and even now the club, it sounds a horrible way of putting it, the club has already made replacement should the proverbial number 19 bus come along for, well, virtually anyone.
Yeah. But Brian, going back to what you were saying a minute ago, I mean, one of those clubs that hasn't got a plan in replacing their manager is Spurs, who we've taken their place in the top six. But they're on to their third different person in the hot seat this season. And it's just that there is no plan. And now they're going to have to rebuild. And they haven't got European football or the money that brings to help.
And I'm sorry, it looks now like, in terms of the head-to-head between Brighton and Tottenham, at least, that controversial game up there won't quite have it won't be Tottenham finishing one point above Brighton when you think about that game that Brighton had up there. Obviously, it still takes 3 points from Brighton, which could have helped them push on even higher. But partly, is it expectation as well? Is it pressure where that makes people make the wrong decisions. You know, Chelsea and Tottenham, they only have to slip a little bit and they're slipping below where they should be and they're in crisis because they're not in the top four, whereas Brighton are... I suppose the test of a Brighton cool head would be if they were in the relegation zone at Christmas, wouldn't it? But I think back to, it's not even 4 years ago, I don't think, when we were at the Amex on the eve of season and they were talking about the top 10 target, i.e. sustained to be a top 10 club, not one top 10 finish and then drop out. And even then that felt really, yeah, it's good to have a target. It's good to have a goal, but are they really going to get that? And now... I know top 10 doesn't mean 10th, but 10th would be a disappointment towards the end of this season, wouldn't it? So
I think probably top 10 to me means not being involved in a relegation scrap.
Yeah. I mean, Gus Poyet spoke about top 10 target in 2010-11. People sort of laughing. And I think it was Tony Millard who said when they won the title, oh, you won the title, you were having us on, you just said top 10. And Poyet said we were top 10.
just at the top of the top 10, absolutely.
But yeah. I thought, you know, it that looked like a goal to aim for, and it's come around, like Al said, just so much more quickly. And as you said, the league placings, each league placing in the top half is a much bigger gap than, say, you know, as you know, 16th to 9th.
Yeah. But it's like when we do our pre-season predictions every year, I mean, one of the questions we normally ask is, how many points are we going to get against the top six? Now, we can't answer that. We can't answer that question next year because we are the top seed in top six. So,
well, I think that it's always about the big six, isn't it? And that big six isn't changing anytime soon. We're talking about clubs with resources. I mean, don't forget, yes, we've got a few extra quid coming in because we've now finished three places higher than last year. And we're going to have a few more quid coming in next year because we're in the Europa League. Absolutely. And it'll improve our standing. But that doesn't necessarily mean to say that the club will massively improve or increase its wage bill. We don't know that because it's not as though money from footfall is necessarily going to massively increase. I think, you know, with Kieran Maguire saying so many times that we're the second or third smallest playing budget in the division, and here we are sort of, you know, thumbing our nose at the big six. I think that what we will talk about next week's show, though, AD, is the number of points that we did get against the big six, and we're miles out.
We were quite a long way out. This is very true. But you know, we'll
we
also talk about our wildcard predictions again now, won't we? But and we'll see how far out you were on that. You'll find out next week. But I do feel you were robbed on this one, Al. I think you were robbed.
Yeah, but having said that, I'm very impressed with the preseason wildcard predictions that the rest of you made. I mean, they are frighteningly accurate. I mean, don't get me wrong. A lot of them were quite fantastic and quite ridiculous, but they're true.
Okay. Well, let's just have a get ourselves a little bit excited and have a look and see about who we could be facing in the European competitions next week. I mean, next season, Brian. I mean, anyone stand out to you? Anywhere you'd like to go? Would the Argus even pay for you to go?
I think I'd sort it somehow. It's looking like Villarreal or Real Betis from Spain, isn't it? And Betis or Sevilla is one of the places that I've always fancied going to. I think it's quite hard at the moment because some of the leagues are not that clear cut. I mean, you say Milan, that would be fantastic. Although I think we would have a good rivalry if it was Atalanta. And this came up in De Zerbi's press conference today in that he's a Brescia man and their arch rivals are Atalanta. And he said, I don't like Atalanta. They're like Crystal Palace to Brighton.
That would be
quite... But it might be that there's somewhere that you don't think and you end up going and you discover some... You know, I suppose you can have your wish list, but I'm sure all of them will have their attractions and you might come up with something that you weren't expecting. So,
Pot four looks fairly unappetizing. You know, Kazakhstan, Belarus,
Karabag.
Yeah, downtown Beirut.
Stone Graz would be good. Toulouse.
Stone Graz is the only one that's mildly appealing at the moment.
Well, Toulouse would be good. Barthe Borisov, that's probably a bit too much. But
no, but you're right about Real Betis. Going to Seville would be great.
I mean, I know the list you're looking at, and I haven't really looked at it at all, to be honest. And also seasons aren't finished in different places. It's about 20 years ago now. I had the pleasure of following the old Brighton basketball team in Europe. It was really enjoyable, really rewarding, very exhausting, quite expensive as well. Even though I did have it paid by some of it, I paid myself and combined as holidays. Some of it I had paid by the Argus. Some of it I had paid by the club. But if you're going somewhere, you obviously end up spending money, even at the airport and what have you. But it was a brilliant experience, and that was 20 years ago. And it's not, sometimes it's tiring and it's a strain at home, and it's inconvenient, but it is really rewarding, and just something that you'll always remember. And I suppose we'll see how the season is panning out as to whether we'll have another crack at it, or whether this is the chance to really make the most of it.
I mean, we'll be playing in the League Cup before we play in the Europa League, so let's not get too carried away.
well, the draw for the games is going to be on the 1st of September.
Can I just also ask? I mean, because I noticed, I think it was the possibility of West Ham, but certainly Liverpool being in pot one, that we can't be drawn against a fellow countryman.
No, that's correct. Round. Yeah.
That's the case, is it?
That is very much the case. You can later on in the competition, of course, sure, not in the first round. So the draw will be made on the 1st of September. The fixture dates, first set of games is on the week of the 21st of September, 5th of October, 26th of October, 9th of November, 30th of November, and 14th of December.
They are the dates, aren't they? It's not the week commencing. I'm pretty sure they are the dates. It's Thursday night, as that, I think.
Yeah. Well, let's hope we don't go too far in the League Cup then. I do fear, and like I say, this is just one of those things that for everyone who wanted a good cup run, and we had two good cup runs, it's kind of, with the players almost like sort of exhaustedly falling over the line. Don't get me wrong, they are playing like heroes, but to a man, even against Southampton, they looked absolutely knackered. Man City will have that, but they've got their depth in the squad and we've got the kids and then everyone else is injured. And even after the kids are injured and won't be long, Brian, they'll be asking you if you want a game. So
just to go back to your pot four, one of these teams is Žalgiris Vilnius in Lithuania. That's one of the cities I went to with the Brighton Bears basketball team.
Yeah.
And that was probably one of the better away trips. That's a fantastic city. You'll probably find beer price is quite cheap as well. So don't be too stereotyped in what you're sort of looking for, or even if it's not the city you're going to.
Vilnius is on my list. There's many things on my list.
And therein lies the point, isn't it? I mean, probably not even at March, a couple of months ago, we would be having this conversation, and we can because we've made it. But isn't it just an astonishing achievement from everyone involved, everyone facing the same way? And like I say, you don't have to throw money at the problem. You don't have to, throw every single sort of penny and resources and make people feel so fearful of it. It's a journey that we've all been on. We've done it together. We, the fans, did it. 26 years ago, we were not wanted on journey within English football. And here we are now about to go into European football.
Yeah.
And we, the fans, did that, and it's just so brilliant.
That's exactly what it is, and I hadn't really thought about it in those terms, and that's something we will be thinking about when we come back next week. So thank you, of course, to Brian Owen. Thank you to Alan Wares. I've been Ailey Packham. This has been the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, of course, on our podcast, and in association with allfootballshirts.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you all again next week. Bye.
Rotterdam is anywhere, anywhere alone. The feeling is gone, only you and I, it means nothing to me.
Dallas, 49, Champs-Élysées, Saint-Michel and old Beaujolais wine.
Dans le port d'Amsterdam, il y a les marins qui chantent, les rêves qui hantent au large d'Amsterdam. Dans le port d'Amsterdam, il y a les marins qui dorment comme des oriflammes le long des berges mortes.
Transparency.